I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all creation, human or wild, vast or small, spiritual encounters that move us beyond words. In the forests of Chile and Argentina, you can find an inconspicuous little plant whose uncommon talent was only recently discovered. It's a vine that morphs in order to mimic its neighbors.
This vine could change the shape of its leaves, the texture of its leaves, the color, the vein pattern, the thickness, the glossiness, to fairly exactly appear to be anything it was growing beside. Like grow a spiky tip at the end of its leaf, which is a hallmark of a species. It would be the equivalent of a human growing a rhinoceros tusk.
And how can any plant do that? Well, we still don't know. What we are learning is that plants are much smarter than we often think. They can even be devious, by the way. More about that later. Plants simply aren't nearly as passive, not as vegetative, as we've long been led to believe.
We've all inherited this cultural understanding of plants as maybe a little more alive than rocks, but less alive than animals. There's a movement now towards recognizing how incredible plants are. And it really brings a lot of re-enchantment into our lives if we consider that. It's very humbling to remember that we are not the only sentient organisms out there.
That's Zoe Schlenger, a science writer for The Atlantic and the author of The Light Eaters: How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. I love the phrase light eaters so much that I wasted no time getting into conversation with her about that very idea. So you wrote this: the roiling plasma surface of the sun flings out a fistful of light. The particles, billions of photons, hurtle 93 million miles through black space to rain down like bread and honey on the outstretched flesh of the most abundant living mass on Earth. Plants eat light. They literally eat light, don't they?
They truly do. Yeah, we don't think of them as having mouths, but they're very much taking in light and air and water and alchemizing that into food to build their bodies. And their food, in this case, is glucose, sugar, which is the same exact thing that builds our bodies as well. So every molecule of glucose we've ever ingested, every bit of sugar that has made it possible for you to live, was first manufactured in a plant body. They're the only organisms that can spin sugar out of thin air that way.
I love that in that same passage you're talking about, well, you and I are having a conversation right now, and that takes thinking and thought, and you talk about our brains, and that our brains rely on glucose probably almost more than anything else.
Exactly. I love the idea that if you are contemplating a flower, it is very much its own kin that made possible that contemplation. The plant is fueling the thoughts you have about plants.
In this episode, we'll get Zoe to tell us about some dynamic and intelligent plants whose superpowers might just blow your plant-fueled brain. But first, let's take a quick glance back at Zoe when she was young to get into her childhood mindset about plants. Even then, she had a suspicion that plants, as she likes to put it, have their own thing going on. 7-year-old Zoe liked to frequent some watery woods behind her house.
I grew up in the woods in Connecticut, suburban Connecticut, but, you know, you can still find patches of woods in suburbia. And in this particular patch of woods, maple, deciduous woods, there were still rock walls running through it. It had been a farmland area maybe 100 years ago. So it was a fairly young forest. And the land sort of dipped down a few dozen yards behind my house and would fill up with water. So it was kind of a vernal pool. And I'd trot out there in my rubber boots and stand in like maybe a foot of water, and just stand there and watch all this drama happening around me. I'm probably 7. There was a pair of mated ducks that lived there. There was a lot of insects, but there were also these plants. And I remember just feeling very much that these plants kind of all had these lifestyles in much the same ways that the ducks did, that they had a sort of thing going on that didn't concern me whatsoever. They were very much leading their lives as organisms do, and I could just be a spectator to all this. And there was all of these great granite rocks around that were just covered in very thick moss. So I would just go pet the mosses, check out the skunk cabbage, which is still one of my favorite plants. Skunk cabbage comes up in winter, actually, or very early spring, often when there's still snow on the ground in the Northeast, and it produces its own heat to burrow up through the snow to melt that snow that's blocking its passage. And they come up in these pointed tips that just pierce through the ground. So I was hanging out with skunk cabbages and moss at the time.
Would you go back there in a heartbeat?
Oh, you bet. Absolutely. I think about that all the time. I think we all should be a little more in touch with our childhood selves who knew how to spend time out in the world that way.
You seem willing to give plants a lot of credit, almost as having a presence, a personality, maybe almost a voice.
All life has their own thing going on. And I'm not sure if I ever quite thought of them as verbally speaking in a way, but they did have a presence for me. They seem to be living their lives, you know?
Fast forward now with me a couple of decades. Zoe Schlenger is writing articles as a science journalist, and she has grown fairly demoralized in her assigned beat, which is climate change. There's more than enough bad news on that front to leave any of us in a deep funk. Well, meanwhile, she's been reading a lot about plant intelligence and following some hot disputes on the matter.
I had been thinking about this plant question and reading all of these studies by botanists who were finding absolutely incredible things about what plants could do, and also sparking this sort of debate within the realm of botany. There were scientists talking to each other about whether or not plants could be considered intelligent or possibly conscious. So I had this all in my mind and went back to my Brooklyn apartment, and I have a lot of houseplants.
What Zoe Schlenger is about to describe turned out to be a turning point for her, or the beginning of a big shift in her thinking about what to do with her professional life, because something needed to give. Well, if a plant could speak, you could almost believe that she got a little guidance from one, or maybe from two.
I had this one absolutely voluminous pothos plant, which I'm sure many people are familiar with, very easy to grow houseplant. And it was hanging from a pot in my kitchen window. I had turned it the day before, and it sort of had swiveled all of its leaves to absolutely plaster themselves against the window. They were all standing sort of upright like hands. They looked like they were high-fiving. And of course, we know this about plants. This is not news to anyone. They seek light, they need light, they eat light, they produce sugar through the catalyst of light. But there was something so creaturely about this action of finally getting to see this change, or just have my eyes open enough to notice it, that every single leaf had changed position since the last time I was home.
You had your moment with the pothos. You noticed the churning of its leaves towards the pane of glass. And within 2 weeks, suddenly, you're deep into ferns. And that's suddenly a big thing for you. That was a pretty rapid change. Let's talk about that fern and why the fascination with that plant in particular.
Sure, yeah. At this point, I'm actually still at this job. And my benevolent editor said, you know, I noticed you're getting a little burnt out on climate change. Why don't you go cover something else for a little while? And so I started putting to use some of these things I was learning about botany. And at that moment, the first fern genome had been sequenced. And this was a big deal. You know, we've sequenced the human genome quite a while ago now. Ferns have huge genomes, much, much larger than ours. And part of that is because they're so ancient. And I was sort of taken with this idea that the ancientness of ferns is part of the reason they have so many copies of chromosomes. I was also so taken with the exact fern that got sequenced, because this fern is called Azolla folliculitis, and it's tiny. It's one of the smallest ferns, and it's a water-dwelling fern. It grows in wet places in these mat-like forms, and it's the size of a fingernail. In fact, the photo that came with the study that I was covering had a picture of the researcher's thumb, his thumbnail, with an Azolla folliculitis sitting on top, and it was so brilliant green. Just imagine the most luminous light-filled green you could possibly picture. And it's this scalloped tiny thing. I just thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And then I started learning more about ferns all around me. And you have to have a lot of respect for something that's essentially not really changed its body plan in millions and millions of years. I mean, these things predate dinosaurs.
When it comes to this plant, your fascination for it fascinates me because, well, I have a twofold reason. First, it's that you just unabashedly love this brilliant green. And then you also have great respect for it because of its venerable ancient history. It sticks around. It has tenacity. Other plants are disappearing. You seem to really like Azolla's long history, its durability.
Azolla was part of the reason the world turned from an incredibly warm place the last time we went through a huge swing, and it sequestered CO2, which is, of course, something I'm thinking about and we're all thinking about as people affected by climate change. How do we bring down our carbon dioxide? So this plant, which is virtually unchanged since then, is now being looked at as another potential nature-based solution to climate change, or one thing that could be used to help bring down CO2 levels again.
You know, a whole lot of birders are known for looking back with a real deep fondness on a certain animal, a bird species, or just a single individual within that species. It's the one that they see on one particularly memorable day, and that becomes what they call their spark bird, that lit a fire under them, it opened their eyes, turned them into devoted birders. It kind of seems to me like Azolla had that same sort of impact on you, even if it wasn't a bird.
It did. It was my spark fern, my spark plant. The other thing I thought was so genius about it is that it has a specialized pocket in its body to house blue-green algae. And this blue-green algae is a nitrogen fixer, which anyone who gardens or farms knows how important nitrogen is to fertility in the soil. Farmers, particularly in Southeast Asia, have known about this for thousands of years. There's evidence that Azolla was used as a fertilizer in rice paddies going back a very long time.
You actually got a tattoo of one?
I did. It is right here. It's on my left arm. It's not as beautiful as the real thing, but it's a nice reminder.
So Zoe, here's where I'd like you to take us next. There you are, you're smitten by Azolla, this tiny little water fern. Ancient genes, ancient green. Seems like you're maybe on the cusp of going just a little bit plant crazy. And you've been building more and more resolve to leave climate change journalism behind you. And then you take up the whole issue of plant intelligence, and you find yourself one day being told by someone to be mean to a plant, to pinch it hard. What was going on there?
Yes, I was at the lab of Simon Gilroy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Simon studies the role of electricity in plant bodies and signaling chemicals in plant bodies. So he would go imbue plants with fluorescent green proteins from jellyfish, which is a tool often used in lots of biology labs, to make something glow so that researchers see that process happening in the body. And so his team had imbued this fluorescence in a small little cress plant, and they put the plant under the microscope, and they handed me a pair of tweezers, and they told me to pinch the plant as hard as I could. And to get it on its midrib, you know, the rib that bisects a leaf, because that's the kind of information superhighway for a plant. That's how its molecules travel through a plant body. So if it was going to get a signal of my pinch, that's how it was going to happen. And so the first time, I pinched the plant, but I couldn't really get myself to truly damage the plant, which is apparently what was required here. And so I saw this little flicker of green go off in this plant, but it wasn't much of a show. And they were like, okay, this time you got to pinch hard. And I pinched hard enough this time, I really crushed the rib of this leaf. And within 30 seconds, there was this green glow that lit up from the place where I'd pinched the plant. In fact, it lit up in exactly the pattern of the indent of the tweezers, as if it was the shadow of the tweezers. And this green glow just traveled down this midrib to the main vein system of the plant. And within 2 minutes, the whole plant, all of its little leaves, had gotten the signal of my pinch. And for the first time, I was seeing this invisible process made tangible to my own eyes, thanks to this fluorescent green protein. But it really awakened me to the fact that no plant is being touched and not noticing, so to speak. Touch is a physical stimulus that is providing information that plant needs. Most often, the plant is assuming it's under attack. It will use this information to boost its immune system, produce defensive compounds, that kind of a thing. But it's not neutral. Touch is not neutral for a plant. And that's really changed my relationship to the plants that I exist with every day. You know, petting a leaf is not necessarily a neutral act for a plant.
So a plant gets harmed and it reacts, and then it may make adjustments in the interest of its own self-preservation. But then apparently there's also a way for it to send out sort of the memo to other plants around it.
Right. So this is research that's been building since the 80s, where we now understand that a plant that's under attack, if it's being munched by caterpillars, let's say, will often release compounds that float through the air and can be absorbed by other plants in the vicinity that alert those plants to the fact of the attack, or at least prompt them to boost their own immune systems, to start to do things like make their leaves more bitter, or maybe make them less nutritious so that, you know, caterpillar doesn't have a chance of surviving very long if they try and eat them. They'll do all of these elaborate things to prevent their chloroplast from being, you know, carried away in insect bodies or deer bodies. And they do that because they've been tipped off by a wounded plant.
Tie this into the acacia trees in Africa, because you tell a story of acacia trees developing high levels of tannins after they've been overgrazed.
Yes. So this is a rare case in this book where this has not been peer reviewed, but this is a story told to me from a wildlife specialist who made this discovery. So it felt worth including anyway, with all the proper caveats. He specializes in game ranches. And there was this problem where all of these game ranches were putting kudu on their property. The game ranch is fenced in, and this is an ungulate. And these ungulates were getting overcrowded, and there wasn't enough grass for them to eat. So this was a known problem in the field. But then suddenly these kudu started dropping dead, apparently. And so this person who I spoke to, who specializes in veterinary science for these animals, they were like, what is going on? He had a hunch that the kudu were actually resorting to eating acacia leaves because of starvation, because they were overcrowded on these game ranches. And he sampled these leaves, and he found that the acacias that were being grazed boosted their levels of tannins gradually, but eventually reached this threshold amount that would kill a kudu. So the plants affected the leaf composition in order to repel these kudu, but the kudu couldn't stop eating the leaves, presumably because they were fenced in a place with not enough grass. And ultimately, it was fatal for some of them. And this really inverts our whole idea of how these actions are supposed to go. You rarely hear about a plant outwitting or killing an animal. We really don't typically think of it, of that action going in that direction, but apparently it can happen.
What do you make of a story that says that plants can sort of fight back in this way?
Oh, they can. And any plant biologist will say that they can. It's a given to the people who study this. They are not passive recipients of their environment. Plants are not just sitting there without defenses. They, like all of us, have adapted ways through the millions of years of their evolution to prevent bad things from happening to them. They want to thrive just like everything else.
And some of the signals that come to plants that let them know that they are under attack are just as simple as vibrations. These are fascinating stories.
Yes, this is now the realm of phytoacoustics, which is a field that's looking at the effect of acoustic vibrations on plant bodies and plant behavior. And so, you know, acoustics, sound. To us, these vibrations register as sounds because we have ears and we have brains that transfer those vibratory signals into sounds. For plants, there's no ears there that we know of. So instead, they are listening in a way to these vibrations. And I got to speak to researchers who are doing things like studying the fact that certain plants appear able to respond to just the audio recording of their predator chewing, as though they were being chewed by the predator themselves. Or primrose, evening primrose, which is a beautiful cup-shaped flower that grows quite low to the ground, will sweeten its nectar by 3 times when it's exposed to the recording of a bee buzzing, which would be their pollinator. So plants certainly are absorbing information we would think of as audio, and for them it's vibration. They are hearing in their own way. I feel comfortable saying that. Not all researchers might, but if we can hold the idea that hearing can be something beyond what we are doing with our brains and rather responding to pure vibration, then yeah, I think plants are hearing.
Zoe Schlanger is a science writer for The Atlantic and author of The Light Eaters, How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. I'm Marcus Smith. Well, since we've been hearing her describe certain plant capacities that seem to be close matches to our traditional notions of what we think of as sentient behavior, you know, the way an animal with a central nervous system like you or like me, the way we behave intelligently, well, I want to tease you now a little with what's coming up next here on Constant Wonder. Important question. Can plants count or tell time? I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. So I want to raise the bar a little now with you here. Let's take it up a notch. We know, of course, that plants can tell time, simply differentiating between day and night, winter and summer, that sort of thing. But you say that there's growing evidence that plants may have more sophisticated means of telling time, and some apparently can even count. So walk me through the notion that a Venus flytrap, for instance, can count.
The Venus flytrap has little trigger hairs in its maw, and that's to prevent them from closing over something that's not actually a living creature. It's very expensive for those traps to close energetically, and they often die after they've eaten one fly. So to be sure that what they've caught is a wriggling, living insect, there's these trigger hairs that have to be flicked in succession. They have to have something like 5 flicks within a certain elapsed period of time, maybe a minute or so, in order to close, and then they have to be flicked yet more in order to begin digestion. So you want this fly to be continuously wriggling. And if the thing stops moving, it will open its maw again. It'll probably conclude in a way, air quotes here, that it's closed over like a bit of stone or something like that. So that means that the Venus flytrap can begin digestion after a certain number of flicks. It can also reset itself if it decides it's not caught prey. That's addition. And that's subtraction, and that's keeping track of time, because this all has to happen within a certain period of time for it to work at all. So the Venus flytrap is a place where counting in plants is best understood, but it's showing up in other plants as well.
So Zoe, I've asked you to open up Pandora's box of scheming, conniving plants, so we may as well turn our attention now to something called dodder, the dodder vine. Which you've gotten me thinking about. I've been reading up on it these days. It's a parasitic plant and apparently can sniff the air to decide which way to go, which way to turn to go after the most nutritious victim.
Definitely. I love talking about dodder vine. And for everyone listening, I have to clarify, it's D-O-D-D-E-R. I've had a couple of people say, why are they calling this parasitic vine a dodder? So this dodder vine, and maybe some people have seen it, it's a pretty common agricultural pest. It is a parasitic vine that emerges from the ground and looks like a little creeping worm. And it's orange because it doesn't need to photosynthesize. It's not green because it gets everything it needs from the bodies of other plants. So picture this little worm-like seedling emerging, no leaves, just a worm. And it's circling the air. And you see this in time lapse. It looks unmistakably like the seedling is sniffing the air for something, and in a way it is. Research has shown that these vines are looking for a host to climb, and they have to find it very quickly before their own built-in nutrients run out. And researchers have found that it will pick up on chemical signals from nearby plants to assess which is likelier to be a good host for them to parasitize. When placed between a wheat plant and a tomato plant, the daughter vine will choose the tomato. It will circle the air for a while and then turn and decidedly grow in the direction of the tomato plant, in part because perhaps the tomato is more nutritious, but also because it has a branching pattern that is easier to climb. It can't climb on a wheat plant or a grass, so there's nothing to grasp onto. So then the daughter detaches its rear end from the ground and climbs over this tomato plant and begins coiling around it. And the number of coils it uses to grasp on represents how much energy it believes it will need to use to parasitize this plant effectively. It'll then start growing these spikes, fang-like spikes all along its edge on both sides, and sink that into the vasculature system of the tomato and start siphoning off all of the nutrients it needs to live. But it won't kill the tomato plant because it's not useful for the daughter to have a dead host. Not all daughters are as skillful as maybe they should be, but basically it would hobble this plant, kind of turning it into its own sort of sugar factory. And often plants that are yoked into daughter service in this way are pretty unable to make fruit. So here is how it becomes an agricultural pest. You can see pictures of fields of crops that are covered in this mass that looks like orange silly string. And really, it's just a mat of daughter vines that have just eclipsed a field and prevented it from producing fruit, but they're having a good lifestyle here. There's incredible research about how these daughters make decisions, how they sense. For example, they're able to sometimes sense which plant has been grown with nutrient supplements and which hadn't, and they will choose the plant grown with extra nutrient supplements, in a lab setting at least. And they're also able to communicate, send signals throughout this, you know, they grow in these masses. There's some research suggesting that that's a communication network as well. So I love daughters. I think they're one of the most mischievous plants ever, and it's really a fascinating strategy for life that not a lot of other plants have taken.
And you wouldn't flinch if I called it a pretty smart plant.
You know, I would call it pretty smart too.
In my conversation with Zoe Schlanger, I found myself wondering over and over again if a plant having smarts isn't just a figure of speech. You know, a strong case could be made that a rosebush is smart to have thorns, or a strawberry plant is clever for sending out those runners to make clones of itself. Is talk about plants being intelligent just a small question of semantics? Or have we, after centuries of watching them, failed to see an active kind of real intelligence in plants and then written them off as machine-like or robotic? Something else I should tell you here. Not long ago, I got some feedback that I won't soon forget. In a Constant Wonder social media reel, I'm on camera out in front of my garden, and I'm sharing some of my thoughts. And the director caught me saying the following as I was inspecting one of my favorite Western wildflowers. It's a pink Palmer's pentstemon. And I said this: why would a plant be persistent in trying to reproduce itself? Why does a plant will to live? Those two questions apparently touched a nerve with a fair number of people who saw the reel, and they feel quite strongly that a vegetable, by definition, is in a vegetative state. Alive, yes, but still unable to will anything. And lacking a will, a plant can't possibly be persistent. Well, that would be like having an attitude. When a Venus flytrap nabs a fly, is it being stealthy, belligerent? Is daughter sneaky because it can curl around a tomato vine and sap its strength? Reserving maybe the best for last, I thought we would hold off until this point in our little survey of some amazing plants. I would hold off on how Zoe went hunting for a remarkable trickster, one of the most talented plants on Earth. It lives in South America, and so naturally she'd have to go there, and scientists have known for only about a decade what it's actually capable of doing.
A few years ago, I heard about this vine in southern Chile called Boquilla trifoliolata that had been very recently discovered to be able to mimic anything it grew beside. Now, we don't have any other examples of this in the plant kingdom. There are some species that can mimic a single other species. I like to think about mistletoe, for example, which is so funny that it's something we, you know, people kiss beneath the mistletoe. But that's a parasitic plant, and it can adapt the form of what it's parasitizing. That's a long evolutionary one-to-one relationship. Suddenly, there's this vine that's always been in this Chilean rainforest, but had just been discovered by a man named Ernesto Giannoli, a scientist there, to be able to morph its body shape into as many as four organisms that it was growing beside. A single plant could do that. And the list had grown to something like 20 different species that he'd found it mimicking. So this vine could change the shape of its leaves, the texture of its leaves, the color, the vein pattern, the thickness, the glossiness, to fairly exactly appear to be anything it was growing beside. And these are things we consider fundamental to a species. It would be able to do things like grow a spiky tip at the end of its leaf, which is a hallmark of a species. And the way Ernesto described this to me was it would be the equivalent of a human growing a rhinoceros tusk. It's something that just doesn't happen. And yet here was this incredibly malleable plant changing its shape left and right. So I flew down to see this for myself, and I met Ernesto and his team of researchers, and we trekked out into the forest. And suddenly there was Boquilla all around me, which was a bit of a shock after spending all of this time looking at journals, papers, photographs of this plant, to suddenly see how common it was and how incredibly ordinary it looked. Boquilla is a trifoliate plant, so it's got three leaves. It's a bit like a bean plant. And these are just normal little ovals, and it's quite small. And it's a vine, so it's climbing up other things. And we were walking around the forest and looking at it, and very often it's just its normal shape, which is this sort of like eggish leaf-shaped, very thin, kind of Kelly green leaves, pleasant but boring. And suddenly, Ernesto calls me over, and we're standing in a sort of clearing where there's bushy vegetation above our heads, maybe going about 6.5 feet, 7 feet up. And he's like, look closer. And he was showing me this plant that had leaves that were maybe almost a foot long, maybe 10 inches long, dark green, pointy, thick leaves. And he was like, can you find the Boquilla in this? And it was remarkable, after I spent a few seconds looking at it, suddenly I realized that the Boquilla that looked absolutely normal with this little oval-shaped shingly leaves to the right had part of its body had veered into this other plant and entwined itself with this other plant. And its leaves had then grown to be the size of this other plant's leaves. It was probably 15, 16 times the size of the Boquilla standard shape, entirely a different shade of green, entirely different texture. And this opened my eyes to finding this absolutely everywhere. I was hiking with this team for about 3-4 days while they did other experiments in the forest, and my only focus was Boquilla. So I was staring at the ground everywhere I could, staring at trees, trying to find this plant doing something unexpected. And everywhere it was mimicking other plants. But at some point we were hiking up a path, and the ground rose to the right of us, and there was water trickling down. So of course there were ferns. Among them were maidenhair ferns, which have kind of ginkgo-shaped leaves and black stems, and they're very dainty and lovely. And I had never seen one in the wild, so I was very excited about this. And I was staring at it, and suddenly I saw a few leaves that were not quite the right shade, but the right shape. And I realized that was Boquilla kind of doing its best to mimic the maidenhair fern. And I called Ernesto over, and he said this was the first example of Boquilla mimicking a fern that they had found. And he, I think, jokingly said he would cite me in the paper once they published, but perhaps they will. Science takes a long time, and this was just a couple of years ago.
So what accounts, if we know, for this plant plagiarism?
There are two main theories. One is that this proves that plants can see. And this is a theory put forward by a group in Bonn in Germany. Plants, we know, can experience different shades of light with exquisite specificity. They have more photoreceptors on their leaves than we have in our eyes. They know if they're being shaded by a cloud or if they're being shaded by another organism. They even know, some species have been found to know based on the quality of the light, whether they're being shaded by a genetic sibling or not, like whether the plant beside them is related. So on some level, that's processing the information of light to come to a conclusion. And there's a way you can stretch that to believe that is some kind of vision. But of course, there's no brain. Anyway, this group in Bonn believes that the capacity to morph its physical characteristics is a sign that there's actually some higher order vision going on. And they'd like to pursue that hypothesis. That would be absolutely incredible. But I'm actually more partial to Ernesto's version. He thinks it's quite silly, this idea that we're talking about plant vision, for whatever it's worth. He thinks that Bokila are actually just incredibly porous to the genetic information of plants beside them. In other words, he thinks that there may be a microbial exchange going on between other plants and this Bokila plant, and that actually it might be something like a cloud of microbes that are determining the shape of most plants, and that Bokila is just more receptive than other plants to the microbial clouds of its neighbors.
So are you saying then perhaps maybe a plant has microbes around it that can transfer sort of a genetic blueprint over to another plant, and the other plant can say, oh, that's nice, I'm going to follow that plan now for a little while?
Exactly. And it's, you know, thinking about it like a fight over the will of the plant to take on new shapes is probably going farther than we should. But it is interesting to think about the fact that we are coming to conclusions about ourselves and the way that microbes govern our own lives that are quite surprising. And certainly there's a lot of organisms for whom their basic functions, it turns out, are mostly due to their microbes, not even to their own biology necessarily. Termites, for example, have been found to be able to digest wood only because of protists living in their guts. So it's not even the termites themselves, at least in the species of termite that was studied, that can digest the wood. It's thanks to a third-party organism. Microbes are affecting the genomes of organisms much more than we thought. And Ernesto, he's one of the only researchers going out in the field and studying Bokila, noticed that Bokila doesn't always mimic its neighbor. It's a sort of patchy effect that he thought looked a lot like infection. And so what is something that can cause infection? Well, viruses and bacteria. So he thought maybe this was more of a bacterial transference that wasn't always successful and didn't always happen, but when it did, had these spectacular results.
And so if a Bokila plant decides, there I'm using the will again as though it had volition, but I'm just toying with you here. If a plant decides it's going to mimic the shape of a fern leaf, maybe that isn't a strategy for survival, it's an infection?
Potentially, it might be a strategy for survival on the part of the microbes. Something Ernesto has found is that Bokila individuals that are taking on mimicking shapes, in other words, that aren't just doing their own thing but are actually mimicking their neighbors, are less likely to be eaten by herbivores that come along. Let's say a deer is coming along, Bokila looks absolutely succulent, and the deer will eat the one that is not mimicking but won't eat the one that's blended itself in with all its neighbors. And that's potentially just a matter of statistics. If you look like everyone else around, maybe you're less likely to get singled out. It does appear to be an advantage for this Bokila to be able to mimic its neighbor plants.
Given all of these amazing recent discoveries that drill down on the question of plant powers, maybe I should just use the loaded word intelligence. Well, there is a backstory that you have included in your book, and I think you did that wisely. It has to do with a scandalous book of some 50 years ago. It's a book that really went off the rails about plants.
Yeah. So you're talking about The Secret Life of Plants, published in 1973, as you said. And probably a lot of people are familiar with this book. It is the reason some people still believe that plants prefer Bach to rock and roll, for example, or that they have any musical genre preference at all, and that perhaps plants can read our minds. There was a whole chapter with a former CIA agent who strapped a polygraph test to his houseplants and determined that they could read his thoughts when he thought about burning them alive. So this was a book that burst into the popular scene at exactly the right moment for sort of New Age culture was at a bit of an apex, and it tarnished the field of botany for 30, 40 years since. The funding bodies that fund science research simply decided to stop funding a lot of, or would be more shy about funding a lot of research that touched on these characteristics of plants that could be considered behavior. They didn't want to see this another iteration of the secret life of plants come up and embarrass the field. Now, you know, 30, 40, 50 years is a long time. A lot of this taboo has worn off. And we are now seeing technology also come in that helps validate things that would be considered ridiculous hypotheses maybe 20, 30 years ago. So the combination of those two things has allowed a lot of new science in the plant behavioral sciences to come through, which is very exciting, but just with peer-reviewed science this time.
As I was visiting with Zoe Schlenger, I just could not not invite her to draw a comparison between plant intelligence and sentience in non-human animals. You know, whenever here on Constant Wonder, whenever we visit with an animal expert, it just reminds me that the whole issue of consciousness in animals, just like the idea of maybe secret life of plants, well, these are considerations that have been revisited in recent history. For example, just a few weeks back, I had a great conversation here with a preeminent expert on bees, his name, Lars Chitka. Lars Chitka is author of The Mind of a Bee. And he said that when he began his own career, scientists were experimenting in those days on cats with very few procedures that were considered to be off limits because, as people believed then, cats don't feel pain. They don't have a kind of consciousness. Well, we now see that as false, as rubbish. Animal consciousness exceeds what was long held to be possible. And just as amazing, in our episode with him, Chitka explained the idea that bees, lone bees, single bees, have individualized consciousness. They don't just work for the full hive as just sort of part of a machine. They might even have differentiated personalities. And most of us just thought of a bee as a little robotic machine. Well, here's where Zoe Schlenger took this opportunity to make a comparison.
It's really instructive to think about the way we've thought about animals over the last 100 years and how much that's changed. There was actually just a meeting of philosophers and biologists and neuroscientists and people who think about consciousness where they put out a declaration that said, we now believe that crustaceans and fish have the substrates for consciousness. And this was an update of another declaration made about 10 years before that, that bestowed consciousness on mammals and birds. So we're constantly, as humans, in this project of widening the circle of our regard and drawing new lines in the sand. But really, biology doesn't care where we draw those lines. Biology and evolution has bestowed the capacity for sensing and responding upon everything that is alive. How we decide to think about plant intelligence or consciousness will be a cultural choice more than it will be a scientific one. It'll be what we decide to believe as people. And of course, it won't matter a whit to the plants themselves. They will just continue doing what they're doing.
A little while ago, you used the word porous. And I was thinking about this porosity. You know, we sometimes think that plants just have their discrete functions and they're tending to themselves and they're minding their own business. And if that's not the case, or if there are instances where that is not the case, and if there's evidence that plants are maybe self-interested, but also really aware with either sight or memory or vision or what have you, if plants are that open to the world around them, there's something in that for me. There's greater connection, I guess. And maybe that's a little too cliche to say it that way. Could you just kind of give us some ideas about this porous, this connected openness to the world that plants seem to have?
Yeah. I think something researching plants really taught me is that Organisms, us included, are so incredibly not separate from our environments. Every single thing that happens in a plant's environment impacts its decision-making and therefore impacts its body plan. The environment literally flows through a plant and alters it in profound ways. And it's not happening in this passive way either. The plant is making good choices for its survival in response to things like water conditions, air conditions, pollution in the air. These all have impacts. And it's such a reminder that we too are profoundly impacted by our environment. We are entangled with it fully. We're not separate really in any way. I came to this also from a background of studying air and water pollution as a climate reporter. And I now have a much more pieced together vision of what it means, let's say, for a population to be exposed to air pollution that affects lung capacity, not only in the population experiencing it, but in the offspring. Their children will have diminished lung capacity often in communities exposed to air pollution. We see the same thing in plants. They teach us so much about this. Plants are able to pass down environmental information to their offspring to set them better up to survive in whatever environment the parent plant found itself in. So let's say a parent was grown in poor water conditions. It will begin to make its roots more adaptable to reach water, make them thinner, more noodly, so they travel farther seeking water. But then, crucially, they'll have children which are immediately equipped with thin, noodly roots, as opposed to having this long lag time. So that is one sense in which it shows us how entangled we are with our environment. And that is a profoundly humbling insight. We can think of ourselves as part of this web of life, not in any way separate from it. Things that are happening to plants are happening to us, and vice versa. And it really brings us back into thinking about the system that we are living in.
Our thanks to Zoe Schlanger. She is a science writer for The Atlantic and author of The Light Eaters: How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. Thanks to you for listening today. I'm Marcus Smith. Today's episode was produced by Eric Schultzka with help from Lily Jensen. I want to let you know about a brand new podcast for children called Constant Wonder Kids. Love to have you take a look at it right now. It's out on all the major podcast platforms. And here's what we've done. We have taken some of our favorite conversations about the amazing world that we live in and edited them down to the stuff that's going to be just really appetizing for elementary schoolers. The first season is all about animals, and we actually think your whole family might have fun listening to these short 12 to 15 minute presentations. Check out Constant Wonder Kids, which, just like Constant Wonder, is a production of BYU Radio. I want to recommend another BYU Radio podcast that I think you'll really enjoy. It's called Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. It's brand new and it has video as well as audio. If you're someone who wants to engage with others on important topics, but you're not sure just how, or maybe you're burned out on social media and you wish you could bring some humanity back into discussions in real life, maybe still online, maybe not, well then Uncomfy is for you. You're going to hear real people describing challenging moments when they decided to stick with the discomfort, and in the process, they found some community healing or learned how to talk about what matters to them or simply discovered greater empathy in their relationships with others. And you can do it too. New episodes of Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us, drop every Wednesday, and you can listen or watch on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.